you've just joined us, you're catching us midstream on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This month on Iowa Public Radio, we've been hearing about how the meat industry shapes our lives, many different perspectives, fascinating reports from our fields to our dinner plates to our waistlines through Harvest Public Media's special report, Choice Cuts, Meat in America. I'm joined now by three public media colleagues who are involved in bringing us this series. Jeremy Bernfeld is with us, editor of Harvest Public Media, based at KCUR in Kansas City. Jeremy, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us by phone also, Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media reporter based out of the Tri-States Public Radio in Macomb, Illinois. Hi, Abby.
Hi.
And Luke Runyon, agribusiness reporter for Harvest Public Media, based out of KUNC in northern Colorado. Hello out west to you, Luke.
Good morning.
All right, still morning there, of course, in the Rocky Mountains. Let me start out with you, Jeremy Bernfeld, as editor of Harvest Public Media. Give us the view of this issue, this topic, from the 30,000-foot level, so to speak. Why do a series about meat in America, and why now?
You know, that is a great question. When we were looking at, you know, how should we dive into something really big, something that really impacts all of us, we bandied about a few different ideas, and we eventually settled on meat for a few reasons. One is that we eat a ton of meat. The average American eats, you know, about 200 pounds of meat a year on average. So it's something that many Americans, certainly not all, but many Americans are eating. And then two, the thing that I think really intrigued us was there are many kind of invisible or at least hard to see impacts of the meat industry from the Midwest, but also elsewhere. When it comes to land use, when it comes to environmental issues, when it comes to health issues, whether it's in your diet or in something like antibiotics. So we thought that there was a lot of kind of perspective that we could bring that you might not really tie to the meat industry, but that's actually really affecting your life.
Okay. There are several aspects, and it's something that you can also go to our website to find a link to all the reporting that you may have missed and not heard on Iowa Public Radio. But let's talk to Abby Wendell about your report. You talked about a report on the role of corn crops in the livestock industry, and people may not realize that when we're passing them on the interstate and on the highways, on our county ways here, Abby. But all that corn out there is going where? Most of it?
Well, the USDA says about like 39% of the corn that we grow in the U.S. goes to feed livestock. But if you kind of delve into that number, it's probably closer to about 60% when you take into consideration all the corn that we export around the world that also goes to feed livestock. And then there's some byproducts of like ethanol, which we also grow corn for, that ends up in the bellies of the cows that we eat. So, you know, I had a friend visiting me from Oklahoma, and we were driving through the fields, and he was like, yeah, that's a lot of corn. And he kind of thought, I think, that it was all sweet corn, that it was like corn on the cob to be buttered. And I was like, Elliot, if you put all of that corn in the grocery store, there would be nothing, like there would be no room for anything else in the grocery store. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of the corn that we grow goes to feed, you know, the fillets that we end up eating.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about, I believe you spoke with a farmer for this story. Tell us about him and the context in which you spoke with him.
Yeah, I spoke to a couple of farmers, and the one who kind of took my heart was Roger Kelso. He's 82, and he farms in western Illinois. He's farmed that ground forever. In fact, it's the same land that his grandfather farmed back in the 1930s and 40s. And we were, you know, in his combine harvesting, and then we hopped into his pickup truck to drive to the grain bins. And while we were driving down, you know, one of those small country roads that's surrounded by cornfields, which some of your listeners are probably doing right now, he started to describe the way that things used to look in the cornfields.
Everybody down through this road we're on here right now, when I was a kid, fed livestock. Right down here, this guy, his name was Logan. He probably fed a couple hundred head. The next guy down the road wasn't as big. He only fed about 50. But everybody had cattle, and if they had 50 head of cattle, they probably had 200 head of hogs, all out on dirt in lots. Most of them weren't out in pasture or anything, because all this ground around here wasn't in pasture, it was farm ground. But back in those days, they might have had a rotation of 2 years of corn, and then maybe oats or wheat, and then hay.
Mm-hmm. How old did you say Roger Kelso is, Abby?
82.
So really a long view of what's been happening in agriculture. I've had the pleasure, too, of actually doing a talk show from the seat in a combine as well recently. But you must have been struck, as I was, about all the high-tech equipment now used in planting and harvesting. And as Roger pointed out, the tremendous strides we're making.
Yeah, I mean, they don't even really have to use their hands very much anymore when they're harvesting. Roger kind of talked about the equipment that his grandfather used to use. But I think what sort of surprised me about that was, you know, two things. First of all, that we were growing a lot of corn back then. I mean, I think we planted close to 90 million acres in 2015, and that's pretty similar to what was planted to corn back in the 1930s. Mm. And, you know, Roger mentioned a couple of other things that smaller diversified farm that his grandfather had grew. But those were, you know, oats and hay. Those were used to feed livestock as well. And sort of the difference was that the animals would be brought to the corn belt in order to get fattened up, and then they would head on trains to, you know, the sort of infamous meatpacking plants in Chicago. Whereas what the kind of big change that happened in, like, after World War II, I think it was like the 50s and 60s, was that a lot of the animals moved out of the Midwest and went to other parts of the country where the climate was a little bit warmer for them. And we just sort of focused on growing corn because it's, crop that sort of fattens them up the quickest.
Right. And get to the point. So some people would wish we would grow fewer crops for animal consumption and more fresh vegetables and whatnot for us, for people, so that we can consume more vegetables from just down the road rather than, I suppose, imported from Mexico, which is where I see a lot of my produce coming from.
Sure, yeah. I mean, especially with, like, you know, the drought in California earlier this summer, a lot of people were asking that question, like, what, you know, why aren't we using all of this good farmland here in the middle of the country to grow, you know, broccoli or something like that? And I don't think it's because farmers are, you know, corn farmers are, like, greedy or grumpy and don't want to eat their broccoli, but it's, they're kind of in this whole system of infrastructure that is built around growing corn in order to feed livestock because people demand a lot of meat. Like Jeremy said, you know, 200 pounds of meat a year we eat, and that's more than any other country on the face of the planet. And, I mean, it takes a lot of corn in order to feed that livestock in order to fill that demand. I think, you know, the Kelsos farm, their corn goes down to chicken feedlots in Texas. And I have a number here, 450,000 bushels of corn in 6 days for like millions of chickens in this chicken feedlot in Texas. That's, it would take, like the corn that Kelso grows in a year, all year long, would get gobbled up in a week and a half.
Mm. That puts it in perspective.
Yeah.
Abby Wendell is with us of Harvest Public Media. Also, Jeremy Bernfeldt of Harvest Public Media and Luke Runyon. We're talking about the series Choice Cuts, Meat in America. We've been hearing it all this month here on Iowa Public Radio. And if you'd like to go to our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, we'll have a link to this series so you can catch up on any of the installments that you didn't get to or hear on our radio live. Luke Runyon, agribusiness reporter for Harvest Public Radio. We're talking to you. You're in northern Colorado. You took the future of the meat industry as your focus and really took on some questions that are kind of disturbing over the lunchtime, I have to say. Are we going to be eating bugs or lab-grown burgers, Luke?
There are definitely a lot of startup companies that would like you to be eating more of their products, and some of those are lab-grown cultured meat, plant-based burgers that are made out of everything from pea protein to algae to your standard soy burger. And, yeah, there's even kind of a movement to get people to eat insects, people building out infrastructure, everything from crickets to mealworms to black soldier fly larvae, you name it.
Mm, yummy. Where are we right now with the technology to grow meat in a lab?
It's still in progress. There's a research team in Europe that's been getting a lot of press. Some people might remember the lab-grown burger that made headlines about a year ago. That burger was several hundred thousand dollars to create. It was grown in a lab from a culture. It's making headway, and the researchers in Europe say that they're getting close to a point where they may be able to make a commercial-grade version of that burger, maybe somewhere around $15 a pound for a thing of beef, so not quite the same, but something that could maybe compete for people who are thinking, you know, I want a piece of meat that has a lesser environmental footprint.
Mm-hmm. Any predictions on when possibly lab-grown meat will be on our store shelves?
I think I'm going to take the long range. I would say maybe like 20 years, 20 to 30 years before you would see something being adopted widespread in grocery stores.
Okay, the other part of the equation you looked at too, one of them was insects here. Of course, a lot of people in the world, millions, I would even venture to say billions of people in our world eat insects in one form or another. You talked to a couple of cricket ranchers in Denver. We want to hear a little bit from them in just a moment, but tell us what this is about.
Yeah, so Taylor Ferguson and Wendy Lou McGill are a couple entrepreneurs in Denver. They run something called Rocky Mountain Micro Ranch. They have these micro livestock is what they're referring to them as, and they're going to be raising crickets for wholesale to restaurants. They found some pretty adventurous chefs in the Denver area who want to use insects in different dishes. So they're using an empty shipping container to build their ranch, and they're doing a bunch of research on how best to raise insects for use as food.
Okay, let's listen to this little clip from Luke Runyon's interview with them.
Something we want to play with later is flavoring crickets through what they eat, which is totally possible. And we also want to test having a generation of crickets eat shake from marijuana production and see if the THC passes through when you eat them. So, you know, there's some real...
It's going to be a really good laboratory.
We're going to have a lot of volunteers for that testing, I feel like.
Okay, Wendy Lou McGill and Taylor Ferguson, cricket ranchers in Denver that Luke Runyon spoke with. We have to talk really about the cultural hurdle we have to get over, don't we, Luke, to start eating bugs? I looked up here. I mean, it makes sense. It makes sense. When I think about, well, bug-like things I already eat, you pick a shrimp, for instance. That's no less kind of strange looking than an insect, I suppose. And Luke, there are some 10 quintillion individual insects estimated on our planet at any one time. 10 quintillion, that's 10 with 18 zeros. So we have a lot of material to work with there, Luke. But the cultural side of this is, do we know why we here in North America, just really most of us don't like the idea of eating bugs?
I think it's the gross-out factor. I mean, you talk to these entrepreneurs who are really trying to make these really compelling, logical arguments about why we should be eating insects, and their arguments are really strong. They talk about the nutrition, high in protein, high in calcium, lesser environmental footprint, but it all breaks down once you start actually putting insects in front of people, and you get the gross noises and the scrunched up noses, and it all kind of collapses with that psychological taboo. And a lot of the entrepreneurs realize that that is the biggest hurdle that they're going to have to face, is convincing people to just give it a try.
Mm-hmm. And how do you do that? Are there thoughts that they had that they shared with you?
Some of the companies that have started up have taken the cute factor. So a lot of their branding and advertising focuses on the cute. So they'll market their products. There's a company out of the East Coast that has a line of chips that are made out of crushed crickets, and they call them chirps. So you've got this.
That's cute.
Exactly. So the idea is that if you can make someone smile or laugh, you break down that barrier and have a little bit of an entry point into getting somebody to try something they might not have ever tried before.
Okay. I have not, Luke. Have you eaten crickets?
I've had some roasted crickets, and they're kind of like popcorn, just with little legs.
Okay. Abby, Jeremy, have you eaten anything like this? Jeremy?
I haven't had the opportunity yet. But I, you know, what I think is interesting about this is there's certainly the rebranding aspect. There's also the kind of refashioning of the cricket. Luke mentioned that sounded pretty interesting, the popcorn, but you can make cricket flour and then turn that into something that doesn't even look like a bug. And so then maybe I'd go for it.
All right.
I had a mealworm when I first moved here, and I thought it was fine. I thought it was salty. And I think that the branding should go more in the direction of, like, James Dean, like something, you know, somebody with, like, a motorcycle jacket on, and, like, I can, you know, I'm hardcore, I can stomach it, can't you?
Luke Runyon, I think you pointed out that we have restaurants and food facilities in the U.S. We have laws against having insects in them, right?
Yeah, I mean, most of the regulation that we have governing insects as food in the United States is saying that insects are not food and trying to keep them out of what we consider food. So the FDA has certain limits about how many insect parts you can have in, say, a jar of peanut butter. But it doesn't have any rules and regulations about what if you want to have a jar full of crickets? What are the regulations? How can we make sure that we keep that food safe? So I would say there's even a legal definition of keeping insects out of our food.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy Bernfeld, we've got about 5 minutes left here. Certainly many other facets that have been tackled by your crew here at Arvis Public Media for this series, Choice Cuts, Meat in America. For instance, very interesting work done by Amy Mayer, who is based in Ames here in Iowa, about antibiotics in being used and the risk that poses.
Yeah, that's such a huge issue. The Centers for Disease Control blames antibiotic resistance for 23,000 deaths here in the U.S. a year. And a lot of that does kind of come through the livestock industry. You know, livestock producers use millions of pounds of antibiotics to produce our food animals. Some of those are antibiotics that are not used by humans, but some of them are. And as you use more antibiotics, you create more antibiotic-resistant bacteria and some more danger.
Mm-hmm. What do you see, Jeremy, and please Abby and Luke chime in on this too if you feel like it. What do you see, Jeremy, as the future of meat in America? What are the major trends you see happening that we are going to experience over the next 5, 10, 20 years that haven't been mentioned yet?
Well, the thing that jumps up to me immediately is a growing recognition of the environmental impact that meat production has on our world. You know, we've talked about the changes in land use, both here in the U.S., you know, the consolidation of the corn and soybean system in the Midwest, but it's also happening globally. I mean, millions of acres are being plowed up of, say, rainforest to make room for more corn and soybeans because this is how we raise cheap meat, and the demand for cheap meat globally is going through the roof. There are other environmental impacts of different styles of production as well. So I think there's a growing recognition that perhaps cost isn't the only thing to take a look at when you're choosing what meat or what food to eat.
Mm-hmm. Awareness among the vast majority of meat eaters eventually, or is this a fringe who's concerned about the planet, concerned about these sort
of impacts? Yeah, I think that's really anyone's guess at the moment. I think what you're seeing when you talk about differentiation in the market, whether it's crickets, which are very clearly a response to the environmental impact of meat, or whether it's something like grass-fed beef, something like local. I think, you know, the environmental impact of our food in general is kind of having a moment currently, and I only see that growing, particularly when it comes to the meat industry.
Mm-hmm. Abby, after you're participating in this series, what do you want to point out that it may be in our future?
I mean, it's a big question, and I think that something that should be,
Mm-hmm. Well, for instance, when you look at the role of corn crops in livestock production, that's not changing anytime soon, is it?
No, I mean, I can't imagine that it would. It would take, you know, lots of investment in other things in order to grow something else here. But I think that kind of like climate change could change our ability to grow as much corn as we grow and grow it where we grow it. So I think that, well, you know, that could change things drastically.
Mm-hmm. Luke Runyon, when you look at the future, also you explored alternative meat to the ones that vegetarians eat currently. There's lots of choices there, aren't there?
Yeah, and there's been a bit of market research and some projections that say that slice of the pie is only going to get bigger, that as you know, people become more aware of their diets as the demand for meat grows, that there's going to be these little niches that are carved out, and people are going to be seeking out more plant-based alternatives, lab-grown insects, you know, you name it. The list is long for the alternatives, but that small piece of the pie could get a little bit bigger.
I guess the big question about a month away from Thanksgiving is, will the tofurkies taste better?
No comment.
No comment. You don't know. Okay, so remind us, how many different aspects have you tackled here, Jeremy, in this series as we close here?
For this series, we have five radio stories that kind of trace different impacts of the meat industry. You can find them on, as you mentioned, IPR website at iowapublicradio.org, as well as at harvestpublicmedia.org/meat. We also produced a half-hour public television production. That one's also called Choice Cut, so you can find that online. You can find it on your local public television station as well. We tried to really give a whole picture of what the meat industry looks like here in the U.S.
Okay, very good. And do check that out, because watch some of those videos there that are also available online. As I mentioned, you can find those links through Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. I want to thank Jeremy Bernfeld, editor at Harvest Public Media, joining us from Kansas City. Abby Wendell, joining us from Macomb, Illinois, Harvest Public Media. And Luke Runyon from Northern Colorado. Thank you for your work in this series and for joining us to discuss it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Okay, it's already Thursday. I guess that means tomorrow is a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Can't wait to find out what's on that plate. I guess I'm not up to date on it. I'll find that out in a few minutes after some lunch. I hope you're having some nice lunch as well. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth, with help from John Pemble today in Des Moines. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.